You're listening to episode 10 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this episode, we talk with Matt Bansal of Dead Gentleman Productions. Running time for this episode is 57 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
And my name's Chad.
And joining us today is Matt Bansal.
Hello.
For those of you who don't recognize Matt by name, you are probably familiar with something he's produced, which is several years ago. Matt, what was the year on the first one?
The first film was 2001.
Okay, so in 2001, Matt writes and directs an internet short film called The Gamers, which probably many people listening to us right now have already seen. How long was it?
It was 48 minutes.
Okay, so it's a 48-minute film about a group of guys role-playing in a dorm while there's a girl down the hall who's trying to study for a test, and the film keeps going back and forth between the perspective of their characters in the fantasy world versus the guys at the table, and going through some of the sort of geek humor and drama that surrounds that. And then you said, now it was filmed in 2005, but not released until 2008. Is that correct?
That is correct. The feature-length sequel, The Gamers, Darkness Rising, in which we tried to answer a lot of the problems that kept the original Gamers from a wider distribution. Because the film that we made, I was told by producers who are my friends and I've come to work with and who worked with us on Darkness, this film is unreleasable, which it was. It's 48 minutes long, which is in that sort of dead zone of time. You know, no one wants to release a film that's that short. I think 80 minutes at the time was, you know, you have to be at least this tall to ride this ride sort of thing. Because it was actually, when it first came out, it was on VHS. And also that the sound was bad. The technical quality was crap. I mean, we did the whole thing for $500. I mean, it wasn't a phenomenal investment. But anyway, the idea behind doing a sequel was, let's try to do the things with the follow-up that kept the first one from wider distribution. And we actually got that. It took many years longer than we thought it would, but it got it. And, you know, now it's on Netflix Watch On Demand, which is pretty cool.
Which is exactly what I was going to follow up with. If you have not seen these two films, you can see the first one on the internet, and I'll try to link at least one source for it.
I'm looking forward to that link, because as big of a fan of the second one as I am, I've never seen the original.
Yeah, I'll link the original one off the show notes. As for the second one, it's available on DVD, and also if you have Netflix streaming, you can watch it via their on-demand feature. Both of these are very funny, very clever films. I highly recommend them if you're into tabletop gaming at all. So you definitely want to check both of these out.
And let me tell you, you know when you made it when somebody pirates your stuff, because I saw the first movie on a pirated video cassette at somebody's party.
Now, Matt, one thing we wanted to clear up or give you a chance to rant about, if you so choose, is when people go searching for your movies, it's oftentimes easy to accidentally end up at a movie called Gamers that was directed by Christopher Foligno, which is not at all the product you made.
No, it wasn't.
And in fact, from what I've seen of it, really has almost nothing in common with what you made.
Yeah, I might call it the opposite of what you made.
Yeah, that one doesn't have goodness in it.
I haven't seen it. I have met Chris Foligno at some conventions. He's a nice guy, comes from the actual film industry. They did have a really strong budget for the level of production that we were doing, and they did it more mockumentary style. And which in a really, really strong idea, I thought, which is, you know, they're chronicling a group of guys who's been playing the equivalent of D&D for, well, I think it was like 20 years or something.
25 years,
Yeah. They were looking to try to set a new record in number of days or weeks or whatever they've consecutively played. And again, I haven't seen it because the opportunities I've had to see it were at the conventions where we had our own things playing and whatnot. So, but
it's one of those things. The concept isn't necessarily bad. I mean, it sounds interesting, a mockumentary and such. But the problem was, where your movies are something that we as gamers see the in jokes, and it was basically done, from my perspective, in a loving manner. Theirs seemed to be more
mean-spirited.
Yes.
Yeah. They were definitely making fun of the subculture in a not nice way. But yeah. Anyway, like you were saying, I'm sure the guy is really nice. Didn't care for his movie, but
well, and that's whatever. I've got a couple questions and comments that I would love to have Matt field about that. But there's something I have to get out of the way first, which is, Matt, I completely agree on your stance on monks, but I completely disagree with your stance on bards.
The bard is basically a therapy for myself. I've played them in a number of campaigns and done worse than the bard in in Darkness Rising.
He officially showed the things you can do with a bard. Maybe he's not so good in combat other than as a human shield, but he could get every barmaid on the way there.
Actually, there's a bit.
Not all those barmaids are bored.
That was my wife, the barmaid. Yeah, that's going in, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, that will.
Okay. Own personal history, I've played a lot of bards. I had a lot of fun with them. My favorite version was I played a Warforged bard in an Emeron campaign whose instrument was a pipe organ he had built into his back.
Wow.
Which was pretty awesome. He would just basically root himself, open his mouth, and blare music.
So wait a minute. You would go into a bar and suddenly start playing with yourself for money?
I pull out
there are
the
laws
stuff
against that sort of thing.
I mean, you know, maybe Everon's a little bit more open-minded of a city than I'm used to playing in, but hey, I don't judge.
Hey, sometimes you got to pull out all the stops.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the bard, basically, it came from some frustration with some of the limitations of the game, in that in order to provide a challenge for your power gamer characters, the level of your difficulty, the difficulty of your monster level challenges has to be, you know, X. Whereas poor Bard, even if he's of an equivalent level, is just, you know, nowhere near on his own something that could survive that level of challenge.
Well, and that was something I noticed that came up in the second movie that surprised me a little bit, because watching the more well-known gamer films, whether it's yours, whether it's Scared of Girls, whether it's, oh, what was that French one with the Boba Fett? It was not French. I'm sorry, it's Canadian, actually, yeah. But it was in French.
Called,
yeah, I can't think what that one was called. But in all of those, they tend to more make fun of the silliness that goes on around the table. And they might get into the culture clash between the gamers and the non-gamers. But something that I have not seen dealt with in any of them until watching your second movie was the debates that occur within the gaming community. And I love, for example, the female gamer that was brought into the group, not because of, oh, it's the girl, but because she was the only one there. You have these guys that are just interested in taking the simplest, most brute-forced, tactless path from A to B, and then along comes this girl who's suddenly actually interested in role-playing, interacting with the NPCs, really getting a sense of the continuity and a sense of the setting.
Mm-hmm. And in essence, was even more of a power gamer than the power gamer once it got down to paper.
Well, for some reason, she had paid attention.
Yeah.
I very much wanted to illustrate the difference you had between story players and rules players and guys who, you know, came to it basically looking for the stereotypical, you know, kick the door in, kill the monster, take its treasure kind of journey. And there's really nothing wrong with that. It's just, I don't think that's enough in and of itself to make an interesting session or an interesting campaign. And I think that actually, if I may be allowed to diverge, it's one of the complaints that I have with 4th edition is that you've got a magnificent combat system, but anything that is not combat related or that can't be put into rounds, there's nothing covering that. And personally, I think it comes from where the current generation of RPG gamers is coming from, what their introduction into fantasy is. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at 1st, 2nd, and even 3rd edition, you had a much stronger, a much higher level of detail going into not just the world's history, but the different relations between the races, the difficulty of magic, what actually happened when you cast a spell, whereas these things are really very small and kind of glossed over in the newer edition. And I think it's because the first generation and second generation of gamers had their into fantasy through literature, mm-hmm. you know, through Tolkien or Eddings or Lloyd Alexander, which is where I came from it. And so their, you know, interpretation of gaming was thinking of it more in terms of this is a novel, this is a global campaign that is going to be unfolding over several sessions where, you know, the depth of the character is as important as what he's killing and what he's killing it with. I mean, definitely, you can say that 4th edition took a ton of its influence from World of Warcraft and from video games. But I think that they're doing a disservice to the legacy of RPGs by tailoring it to an audience that has their into fantasy through video games or comics that just does not have that depth of world to it. There's not room for the world to breathe.
Well, there's not room for the story. You know,
yes.
I think that the tendency is that people take role-playing games and they see everything that's defined in the world is laid out in front of them on the book. It's defined on how you jump over a cliff. It's defined on how you punch a guy in the face. It's defined on how you buy things. But what role-playing games don't define is how to role-play, how to tell the story, how to be right. in character, how to do all of this. Because honestly, none of that is really heavily quantifiable. You can't put a number behind in-character-ness. I mean, I guess you can, but I mean, it's highly subjective. It's not mathematical. The books fail at that because they can't really do that. And then these publishers make a book that is 90% combat stats and charts, and then 10% of the book is the story. Well, the story they want to get out as much as possible. So it's this big, overarching, huge worldview. I mean, this 300-mile view of the story, and the characters don't ever have that 300-mile play. They have a zoomed in, I'm sitting in the tavern in the village trying to save the princess from the dragon. Mm-hmm. And a new players or people who are introduced into this, if they're not taught by the old guard, I guess, they don't know to role play. And I think that's where you get a lot of the stories of people who, you know, everyone has their teenage years of role playing when it was just hacking and slashing and hacking and slashing. And then I think that people tend to get bored with that. And eventually they start adding in more story elements, more character elements, and not less in the quantity of combat. I mean, that's just personal preference right there. But they start putting more into the overall game that isn't combat.
Right. Well, I mean, it goes back also to, you can play an entire session where you don't roll the dice. And if your characters are strong enough, you're still having a grand old time.
Exactly. We do that on a regular basis, actually. It's right. pretty common for us to go through a game without rolling dice, or maybe go through a couple games without combat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I completely agree. And a lot of the humor in the gamers' movies has come out of that. When I DM, I'm a story DM. I don't really care about the results of the dice sometimes, and you know, butting heads with players who want to use the stats and the rules for everything. Whereas, no, you know, it's the rules are a tool for the telling of the story.
I could definitely see that conflict coming out, particularly in the second film, because some of the points that were made and the ways in which they were made were a little too accurate to simply be estimations of a viewpoint. I could tell they were coming from personal frustration.
Yeah, and the whole movie was essentially that path for a group going from the ROLL playing to ROLE playing. Mm-hmm. That whole concept. I mean, in the beginning, you've got, you know, the power gamer, and you've got all these archetypes, and they're moving more and discovering the idea of a game that has more than just combat.
So, Matt, let me ask you something. When you set out to make this movie, and by this movie, I could be the first one, the second one, both of them, what was your intention for these films? What was your goal?
I'll tell you, for the first one, my goal was just to make a Dungeons & Dragons-style movie. I'd never seen one before. And at the time, I had made two features, two very, very low-budget horror comedies, but features, with some friends of mine at university.
Was that the Demon Hunters?
These are the Demon Hunters movies.
I've heard of them. I've seen them on your website. I haven't actually watched them yet. I plan to, though.
They're fun. They star a bunch of overacting 19 and 20-year-olds, but the core of it is good, and it's fun, and it's still enjoyable. I mean, hell, Margaret Weiss Productions did a role-playing game based on it.
Hmm.
Which is, you know, a different subject. But after that, we did those. We did two features in 2 years that were a hit on campus. And I'd written both of those, but I hadn't directed because I didn't know what went into the directing. And after watching the guys who directed do that, I felt, okay, I think I've gleaned enough that I can do a short on my own. And I had this short, which was The Gamers, that was going to be part of a larger sort of pastiche of short films tied together with a narrative through line. It was going to be sort of like a scenes from weird stuff happening at college. And this was what the guys in the basement were doing. And that project fell apart. So I said, well, I can still do this on my own, extended it a bit, and shot it, paying for it out of pocket. The whole thing cost us $500. And I mean, the goal was never to make anything necessarily that we would sell. The goal was to have fun and make something I might take out and show to some friends of mine or show to a gaming group, you know, 5-10 years down the line. And about halfway through it, we kind of realized we had something special. I think we were on location in Aberdeen, Washington, doing the Ambrose the Mage falling out of the sky shot, which is we put it in context, they're trying to knock out the wizard who has a fear of water and thus cannot cross a stream. So, and in the barbarian, in trying to knock him out, rolls a critical success and punches him into the sky. And he
He's the B.A. Baracus of the team.
Yeah, exactly. He kills his teammate trying to overcome task. And we did this by dressing a dummy in the guy's costume, hauling it up to a train trestle and chucking it off. And it would did a header into the gravel from 50 feet up, and watching it, crash down over and over again, and kind of thought, every gamer might want a copy of this. This is kind of fun. And then, the year after that, my partner, Ben Dobbins, who I'm working with on a number of things. In fact, we're starting a new company. We have a couple of web series that we're doing, starting up this year, sent it out to a bunch of festivals, not knowing where it would land. And it landed at a handful of them. Like Archon was one of the ones, the first ones that took us, and the Hawaii International Film Festivals for some reason.
That's the one to go to.
Definitely. Because specifically the gamers really fit in with their theme of trying to increase the profile of Polynesian filmmaking. So yeah.
I see the tie-in. I don't know. Just roll with you guys.
So, I could work it in.
People really liked it, and apparently the word started to spread, and then the next round of conventions, we were invited to more, and by 2003, people were clamoring to have it for sale, and so we put it out a VHS, and a lot of people said no, because we'd done VHS for the Demon Hunters movies before with a run of like 100, which was awesome for us. And people said, no, we wanted a DVD. So we was like, all right. So we put together a DVD. We went to our first Gen Con in 2003 and sold an F-ton of them, completely unexpected. We were off. And the film since then has gone on to sell about 20,000 copies.
Cool. That's great.
I know. I saw it first on DVD when it was on Netflix. And I rented it. I watched it. Absolutely loved it. And then the moment it hit Netflix streaming, my wife saw it on there and thought, hey, I bet he would like that. And we watched it together. And that was one thing that I think you've accomplished here is people that aren't gamers, that haven't been part of that whole environment. My wife still loved it. She may not have got all the jokes, but it was funny enough that she really got into it, too.
Yeah, I had the same experience. My wife, she's played a few role-playing games, but she's not an avid gamer. And she still, though, when I put it on, she started watching it with me. And she was able to laugh right along with it. The jokes were not so obscure that you have to be familiar with this or that really weird rule set or quirk of the community to catch what's going on.
There's all these jokes for everyone coming to watch it. And then there's the in jokes and the eye winks for us.
So were your intentions any different with the second one?
Well, the intention definitely was to try to reach a broader audience like that, to make it accessible. And I'll say that like you said, one of the best pieces of feedback we get from people is, I can show this to my non-gamer friends and they can love it. Or I can show this to my family to say, this is what we do. At the same token, the very worst response that we can get, and it's usually accompanied by a four or five star rating on Amazon or Netflix, is, you know what, I love this movie, it's great, but unless you're a gamer, you won't get it, so don't bother. Which is I hate, because it's not true, and two, it's limiting in its scope. And one of the main goals of the sequel was to try to make it accessible to a wider audience. And that was the reason for the inclusion of Joanna as a character, played beautifully by Carol Roscoe, one of the best actresses in Seattle. And it's through the eyes of the neophyte that we are able to explain a few things. Here's how you create your character. Here's how combat works. Here's what an NPC is. Here's how this works. So instead of just throwing people into it, there's a bit of a, here are a few steps you take, now you're ready to run.
There's something I wanted to ask you along those lines, which is, as I watch films like The Gamers or Scared of Girls or that French Canadian one, I still can't remember the name of it. Somebody's going to be posting here in the show notes once we get this done. But anyway, one of the things that I see repeatedly in those movies, there's a lot of things that are shown from the perspective of somebody in the community that we understand what's going on here because we've gamed with that guy. We've seen these things happen. If we're really honest, to some extent, we've all been that guy. But these are things that we've kind of picked up as trends that we see in the broad term over a career as a gamer. Average group is not that persistently socially inept and utterly dysfunctional and et cetera, et cetera. In fact, when I talk to a lot of non-gamers, be they friends or people I interact with through this podcast, the two things I find they always have massive misconceptions about is what a role-playing game is and what gamers are like. That typically, if they even know what a role-playing game is at all. And they've gotten past the whole Blackleaf thing and you just sit around worshiping the devil. Then typically where I get is you sit around in mom's basement, none of you are married, you've never kissed a girl, you've all got buck teeth and haven't showered. And
200 extra pounds.
Yeah, 200 extra pounds. And you sit around arguing about who's got the most powerful wizard for killing orcs.
I never understood that stereotype. And the reason I don't is that it basically says a person who roleplays is socially inept. But
role-playing
is the most social game you can play.
So here's my question. When you made a movie like this, where a lot of the humor is based on things that we within the community would understand the context and scope of the joke, but someone else outside of the community might look at that and say, oh, yeah, that's what these gamers are all really like. Did that figure into the math at all? Or was this more something where you kind of figured this was mostly an in-joke for the gaming community anyway?
For the first one, I basically figured I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to make anyone a caricature, first off. I'm not going to make anyone in, you know, stereotypical nerd, dork clothes. No one's going to have tape on their glasses. You know, we're not going to have people drooling when they see women sort of situation. I mean, there's a little bit of that in the characters in the original, but I really didn't.
No place in the movie for you, Pat.
I know.
Wayne was making fun of Pat. Go on.
Okay. For the sequel, you know, I just, you mentioned earlier that one of the things that I think one of the reasons why the gaming community has embraced the movie is because we're not disparaging either the people involved or the hobby itself. You know, it's real people who play these games. Maybe they are part of a subculture that the culture as a large isn't aware of what goes on in it, but it's a group of friends arguing over stuff. I mean, it could be the same types of characters. If you took them out of this movie and put them into, say, a fantasy football league, they're going to be arguing over the same sort of things. You know, they're relatable people. You understand that these are folks who are used to spending time together and they chafe creatively.
So along those lines of the arguing at the table, one thing that I noticed in the movie, I don't want to get too into individual scenes, but there was something that you did in the movie that I'm curious if you do in your actual gaming group. And that's when they were all sitting around bickering when they first created their characters. Your DM in the movie just starts singing a song. And that seems to be the cue for everyone to shut up, get in character, and start playing. We've talked about having those cues before. So I'm kind of curious if you actually do that in your gaming group.
I don't. As that scene was originally written, it just devolved into everyone talking over each other, and we just transitioned on into the intro to the game. As Lodge, the game master, said, "Okay, finally, no, we're talking. We're starting now." The song came out of the mad brain of Nathan Rice, who plays the dungeon master and the paladin and NPC. He did some writing on the script because he was part of the development team, and there are a few things that he really wanted to put in there. But that didn't necessarily fit. Yet, when he's behind the camera, he can be a bit of a sniper actor in that if he wants to do something, he'll do it anyway. If we have the time left for it, and 9 times out of 10, it wound up in the movie. The Stab It song was his. The improv Buddha Weiser line, an outtake, that was Nathan. Because Dead Gentleman had a very talented improv troupe for a long time. All that stuff at the end, after the credits, where the paladins running around yelling the succulent jam of light and stuff was, again, came out of Nathan. I'm like, why would I don't, where, there's no room to put this. This doesn't track logically. Well, he waits for, you know, we've done 3 or 4 takes, so it's in the can, then he does it anyway. So I'm like, whatever.
How much of the movie was improv versus actually scripted?
I try not to make people adhere rigidly to the lines. I mean, lines really should be treated more as suggestions and guideposts than something you should rigidly adhere to, because, you know, you're always going to come across lines that are harder to say than they are to read or perceive of in your mind. And if people are too worried about getting every single word out exactly correctly, one, it doesn't sound necessarily natural, and two, it stifles the creative impulses. There's a lot of stuff in there that was improv'd that I mean, I could pull out a few examples. A lot of the bickering around the table, the little stuff, Gropey and Dopey was improv. It's just, and when you have a group of actors that talented, you learn to trust them. You know, worst case scenario, if it falls apart and they start laughing, well, okay, you put it in the outtakes. If it works, you've got gold and it looks magnificent.
Of the actors, how many of them are also role players?
When we started, I think of the main 6 leads, 3 of them were. By the time we were done, 5 of them were.
Wow. Awesome.
And the sixth had played before but was retired.
Something I was curious about is because of the fact that, presuming there's any level of story or role-playing at all to your game, there's some degree of acting as well to your game.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a guy on who's a professional comedian, but he's also got a little bit of background in acting on recently, to talk about places where he feels like gaming and acting do and don't overlap. But I'm curious to hear your take on that as well. How do you think the skills these people built as actors or role players kind of spills over into the other realm? I mean, did their background as role players help them improv or run with these scenes? Did their skills as actors later figure into RPGs you guys played together?
I'd say absolutely, because key to both role playing and acting is character creation. And not just the character creation of your stats, but what is the backstory? Why does your character react the way he or she does to these stimuli? If when acting you're just playing what's on the page, if you haven't done your homework, you deliver a very sort of one-note hollow performance. It's the backstory work that actors do to inform the decision, stuff that never has to come out on screen, kind of stuff that you never see, that gives that sort of depth of emotion and truth that makes a good actor great. Similarly, with RPGs, the guys who do a ton of backstory work on their characters have the most rounded characters and are the most fun to play with. One of my favorite people to play with is a friend of mine named Steve Payne, who is an absolute game breaker. The guy's an engineer and has been able to, in the 20 years I've known him, take a look at any RPG system and make the most disgustingly broken game-raping character you could ever imagine. Yet he doesn't abuse it. You know, he'll make this ridiculously overpowerful character, but with such an interesting story that there are things that prevent him from using these skills in certain circumstances. You know, code of honor, I'm not going to hit anyone when he's down.
That is an oddity. Everyone I've known who has set out with that kind of min-maxing as the foundation of the character, whatever problems they give themselves, I have this massive power, but I'm never going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, BS. Give them a couple games in, and they'll find some excuse to start whipping it out. They'll find some little loophole. So you have found a treasure in this man. Let me tell you that straight up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that part of it is because, also, if you have a group that does nothing but min-max, it's like playing a game on God mode. It gets boring after a while. I play bards. What do I know?
Everything, as far as I'm concerned. See, you said when you started out that three of them are role players. By the end of it, five of them were. I am curious, how did the other two get sold?
And was the gamer girl a previous role player or one of the new people?
She was a previous role player. And the two new guys were, I think, Leo and Cass were the two who had, those are the character names. Who joined up later. It's actually one of the things I missed out on is we wrapped filming in early June of 2005, and a month later, my wife and I were moving down to Los Angeles, and I actually didn't get to cash in on the friendships that developed during the shoot, though we're excited we're going to be moving back this year and have another project starting up soon with many of the same people. So I really don't know because I haven't had a chance to game with a lot of them. But since 2006, 7, and 8, many of the cast went to Gen Con and PAX and Comic Con because we were screening it at those locations. In 2008, we did a signing at the Paizo booth and we sold over 1,000 DVDs. And
cool.
In 4 days. Yeah, people, autograph lines going off. It was great.
So if you decided to do a third movie along these lines, what mm-hmm. would you do differently? Basically, what have you learned out of the first two that you would take in as experience for the next one?
I think the biggest mistake I made on the second one was not stating flat out, your characters do not know that they're in a comedy, which chalk up to inexperience. This is my first feature. I think there are points when people are playing the laughs rather than just letting the situation unfold naturally. And you know what? It works, because especially in the fantasy world, because if the guys are laughing in the real world, they'd be laughing in the game. That's fine. It's good. But I think that that's one thing I would change. As for what else I would do, I don't know. It really depends on the project.
One of the things that I have always wondered about as a role-playing gamer, I mean, they say statistically, I mean, there are several million households in the United States alone that at least have a copy of the D&D rulebook sitting somewhere. That there are a lot more gamers than most people think there are. And the second thing I've noticed kind of along those lines, and you'll see in a second I want to tie these two thoughts together, okay, is that just as comic books have a lot of great intellectual properties, which have certainly in recent years shown their legs in the mainstream, I think role-playing games and their settings and stories also have a lot of great ideas and stories and characters that, mm-hmm, if done right, could sell in the mainstream.
Absolutely. Spelljammer and Dark Sun are two of the greatest fantasy settings I think have ever been conceived of. It's one of the crimes against humanity that was the Dungeons & Dragons movie, is at that point you had 30-plus years of New York Times best-selling authors crafting your worlds from you, and that's what you go with?
Well, that was something that I thought about for a while, and I had a brief conversation a while back with a travel agent who has started doing trips that are specifically designed for gamers, where you might go on the one that I'm going on actually in March. I won't be participating in the tournament, but it's a Caribbean cruise where they have some guys out there from, I think it's Mayfair, and they do a Settlers of Catan tournament on it and such. But here's this group of people that are clearly willing to depart with their disposable income or passionate about their hobbies, have stories and ideas and properties that would have wonderful legs in the mainstream, and yet for years, none of it made it into the mainstream media. And now that it has, quite frankly, the handful of projects that have come out have just been embarrassments. I'm sorry to say. I mean, they've just been outright embarrassments. And I'm excluding present company for a simple reason. Yours is meant to be a comedy. The D&D movie was not supposed to be a comedy. The Dragonlance movie was not supposed to be a comedy. These weren't supposed to be funny caricatures. And I'm curious, as a filmmaker, do you think a day will ever come, or maybe even something you'll be a part of sometime down the road, to really bring serious attention and high quality production to all of these stories that just sit there so, I don't know, latently or passively waiting to come out?
I mean, do I think any of these great old RPG settings would ever be optioned and made into serious, successful dramas?
Yeah.
I really don't know. It depends on whether or not the production has to be married to that it is a role-playing game that it's coming from. You know, whether you can free the rules background from the story itself. Because I have friends who worked on some of the Dungeons & Dragons movies. And, you know, these are film people who love D&D and want to do it justice. But a lot of times you're running into problems with the people who have the power to say yes or no on it. One example was, how do you illustrate the idea that a wizard can only cast so many spells a day, right? How do you get into that? Well, what they were forced to go with was, a wizard can only cast so many spells today. Not, I am exhausted, I'm out of mana, I must, you know, the spell is gone from my memory, I need hours to study it. It's, no, a wizard can only cast so many spells per day.
That must have been a painful experience for them, actually liking the product and,
oh, absolutely,
having to put that out.
And that's where it gets to, is if you are too married to a literal interpretation of the rules, you have no room to make it something, again, more accessible to the public. I mean, I would love to see a wizard in a situation like that saying, I can't, I am exhausted, I can create, you know, I've got great cosmic power, but not anymore. I need my beauty sleep, sort of, yeah, sleep, other than, no, sorry, I'm out for the day.
Well, isn't that something, though, that you could get around with one of two things? One would be a very brief exposition where you have the wandering rogue who's never really encountered a wizard before, and the wizard explains to him in 15 seconds of dialogue, I study these patterns which become imprinted upon my mind, but when I actually create the fire, these patterns are lost from my memory as if I never knew them before. Some, you know, it's some bit of exposition. Or as a second thing, for example, I know years back, Battletech, I believe, got optioned for a movie that was never actually made. And in something like that, you know, do you have to deal with the fact that this gun does this much damage and this mech has this much armor? No. But you could,
but you could
have things like, for example, a mech won't go down until it has taken what a rules lawyer would recognize as the appropriate amount of damage, and the audience simply is none the wiser to the math that went into it.
Well, that actually gets at the question, is who would you be making this material for? If you're making it just for the audience who knows the rules, then I think you've kind of you failed in your endeavor, which is well, the rule of movies specifically is only the last sequel fails to make money. You've got to make your money back, and you do that by making it as accessible as possible. One of the things I learned in film school, actually, was kind of an eye-opening event. It was one of these things you think about, and you're like, well, duh, but it makes absolute sense. And that is when you're doing genre, specifically sci-fi or fantasy, I don't need to know how it works. I need to know what it does.
Yeah, this is very true.
Like, let's go back and let's say that wizard and that rogue meeting in the woods. What's more entertaining and makes us want to watch more? The wizard explaining magic. And the idea of explaining magic to me is just abhorrent. It's magic. It's supposed to be grand and mysterious and unknowable and dangerous and chaotic and the purvey of men of great might and craft, and women, sorry. We're slipping into Tolkien there for a while. Who they themselves are not fully sure they can control all the time. You don't have to explain magic. It's enough to know the guy's got great cosmic power and
yeah. I guess
he doesn't like to discuss it.
I think that's one of the big differences in genres, too, between magic and science fiction. In magic, I completely agree. I don't need to know how it works. It's magic. In science fiction, I want a little more details. I want a little bit more of that.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with what you're saying, Wayne. I mean, I agree with him because in a movie, you have an hour and a half, 2 hours, yeah, whatever, and dry exposition is boring.
Well, I think, but there's got to be some middle road there where, like I said, you can do one of two things. One is keep the exposition absolutely brief. And right. I'll talk to the magic thing here in a second, but keep the exposition absolutely brief. Or secondly, is don't give the exposition.
It's not a matter of, with exposition in the length, it's not a matter of the length that makes it boring. It's the matter of there's a flow to the movie. There's a story, a dialogue, or a narrative that you're kind of going with, like a boat in a river going down, and then exposition stops. Exposition stops the whole process, and it says, okay, A, B, and C.
Well,
you
I
got
don't,
it? Okay, now go on with the flow.
I don't know that I want to get it caught up too far on that rabbit trail. I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, running through my head, I can come up with multiple movies where at some point they had to stop and do a quick aside to explain something. But if the writing was good, it fit in very naturally with the situation.
Like in, for example, this movie, they had a new player. They were able to give a little bit of exposition because the player didn't know it.
And it never broke the flow of the movie. But the second thing I would kind of put up before is don't explain it. You don't need to. But the fact that you're not explaining it does not therefore somehow also necessitate you must be inconsistent with the universe. If the wizard gets only two fireballs a day, he only casts two fireballs. The reason why just never needs to come up.
And you're actually, one thing we've discovered is you are more beholden to the rules of your world if you are doing something that is set in a fantasy or a sci-fi universe. You have less wiggle room to fudge your own rules. If you set something fast and hard, you cannot violate that, or you've annoyed your audience. You're like, well, now why am I following this now if you can break the rules that you just set up?
Like if you can separate a paladin from his god.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and that's something even outside of the getting away from movies and entertainment, I mean, it comes up in role-playing games, and this is one of the internal debates I mentioned earlier that I love watching play out in that second movie, The Darkness Rising. Was there's that debate right near the start of the movie about setting versus rules, where you have one character saying, wait a minute, or and by character I mean actor, I don't mean the player character, we have one actor saying, wait a minute, the rules say you can't do this, the universe works this way.
If you would have told me this, I would have never made that character.
Yeah, and the game master pushing back and saying, no, but my setting works this way, and I think the story ought to trump the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I could think of, once again, I really, at least how it looked to me was, I could tell there was some personal frustration that was coming through.
I have a guy I've gamed with routinely who tends to make MacGyver PCs, as in the guy is equipped for any eventuality, any potential eventuality. You cannot catch this guy with his pants down. You can't surprise him. You can't get advantage on him. He has basically mapped out every potential path of danger towards his character, more so than you have. And if he's caught in a situation where he doesn't know where to act, he'll argue as to why he shouldn't have been caught that way, which is immensely frustrating because it's, come on, just play the game. I'm not trying to kill you. But there are some players who play the game. It's a team effort. We are off to solve the mystery that is this campaign. Then there are characters who look at it as it's me versus the DM. And yes, there's been some fodder for...
we've long espoused on the show that that is one of the worst attitudes you can bring into role-playing, is that it's a competitive sport, that it's the players versus the DM.
The DM versus the players, yeah, is even worse.
I guess that was kind of reflexive in my mind. It's one and the same, that first off, the DM's going to win. Guess what? I mean, he's effectively God over this universe.
Rocks fall, everybody dies.
Yeah, precisely. And we have found in our experience that the stories we can tell and the drama that we can build working together as a team with the game master and the players and everybody on the same page is so much better than what we can get if basically the players are constantly having to watch their back because they know the DM's just out to get them.
Right. And I think that it all comes down, really, to a matter of trust. I like to surprise characters with dramatically appropriate moments, with scenes that, if I were filming them or whatnot, they would essentially be cut scenes, right? I need you to be abducted here, to be spirited away to this meeting with the head of the resistance movement, all right? In order for the story to continue, I need that or something like that to happen. Please don't waste an hour arguing to me why you wouldn't be ambushed or fighting back and killing everyone in the party who's not actually trying to hurt you, but just usher you on along in the story. Again, it's a matter of trust. I'm not going to murder you as the DM. Yeah. I need you to trust me that I'm going to let you play your characters and be awesome and have a wonderful time.
And I think that's hard for a lot of people, because in a story or a film, that's absolutely natural. It happens all the time. It's tropes. Mm-hmm. But in a game, it's counterintuitive, because you are losing. The trap is sprung on you. You are kidnapped. You are knocked out. You are taken away. All your stuff is taken away. It's loss, 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 loss in the sort of short-term narrow view of it. But from the game master's perspective, it's like, no.
It's part of a narrative.
It's part of a narrative, and you guys are winning. This is me delivering you to the wind, to the big cutscene where you get to free yourself from the captors and you get to spit in the guy's face and show your act of defiance and then make your getaway and do all this stuff. Which do you want to do? Do you want to punch the head priest in the face of the cult that kidnapped you and free all the people and destroy the cult? Or do you want to beat up a bunch of mooks that are trying to kidnap you to get you there?
Yeah, I think, right. I think you hit it on the head with that, Chad, and the fact that I was thinking, I think the players are in the short term. I think they are very short term minded, whereas the DM is looking at the big picture, the long term, or that's the gap that has to be bridged.
Yeah,
and I know I've always strived. I've really tried to do that when I'm at the table and get into that mode of let's get out of the short term thinking. Let me be a little bit more open minded about this and go with it. Like you said, because that's what we see in movies all the time. I mean, we expect it. It's just expected, but for whatever reason, we get bound. We sit down at a table with some dice in our hand, and all of a sudden,
and you're right. I'm not going to let that happen to me.
And you think, if I do this, I lose, I die. But no, it's the bigger story.
The best way I've seen to deal with it is for the game master to present the players with a cost-benefit analysis. And not line it out and be all business bureaucratic about it. But
here's the spreadsheet.
Yeah. you don't want to do that. But just do this sort of conceptually where you say, okay, you can fight the mooks, but if you kill them, you're not going to get anywhere, and the fight's not going to go well for you. You know, it's not the right time. They have the jump on you. Yes, you can do it. You can fight. And I'm going to let you do it if you choose to do that. But it's not going to go well. You're going to take losses. You're going to get hurt. You're going to scare away whatever. You're going to do whatever. And kind of leave it open for them. And I've seen Dan do that. And we have a homebrew game called Skies of Glass. And
yeah, I'm not saying you don't want to do this. But
And Dan had it where our characters all hold up in a building and then all the bad guys, not all the bad guys, minions of the bad guys surrounded the place. And we were faced with a choice, which we talked about for 2.5 hours of what we're going to do, of do we make a last stand and fight it out, or do we surrender and go with them and try to get a better advantage later? And it was interesting what happened out of that.
So I'm kind of curious at the table, how do you deal with that indecision? Because it's something we talk about here all the time. We have a trope we refer to as sausages, because once in two games ago, Chad's character came up with a plan of buying sausages. And then an hour and a half later, they're still debating whether or not he should buy sausages.
Oh, God, we've had those before. That, yeah, I don't mind non-combat conversations of world and whatnot, but that's just getting lost in it. When you're getting bored by your own fantasy, I think it's time to move.
Yeah, I had that problem every once in a while. I just switch it up a little bit, you know? I think of a redhead instead of a brunette.
Sorry, I was saying, I think a lot of it comes down to being able to say to the characters, look, a real person would not act this way given this situation. All right? You see 20 armed guys. You don't know that they are minions. They only have one hit die. You don't know. You know, it's... Mm-hmm. It can lead to unrealistic, of course. Yeah. Well, that's where all the humor from the movie comes from. It's unrealistic reactions to situations. You know, an arrow in the eye is going to kill a 30th level character. I don't care.
And I think that's a problem. I think that the players are like, yeah, 20 minions are in front of me, but you know what? I've got a gun that has 25 bullets in it. It's on. You know. Yeah. So nobody thinks like that.
So Matt, let me ask you a question. After watching the movies, obviously you play D&D. That doesn't take a real genius to figure out. And by looking at some of the products that appear in the second movie, I'm guessing you also are into some of the Steve Jackson stuff like GURPS and Munchkin. Mm-hmm. But those games aside, what's the rest of your RPG resume? What are some other games you like? Maybe ones that didn't come up in either of the movies.
Well, I have a friend, Matt DeMille, who's a production designer on the film, who has his own homebrew company called New Dimension Games that are really, really strong. I've gamed with them before, and they feel very, very much like old first edition D&D. The stuff where if you make a mistake, it's going to be a lethal mistake, likely. So, and you don't have the opportunity to pretty much memorize the rule book and the monster manual and know how to deal with any situation as a player rather than a character. So it's some of the most rewarding gaming I've ever done because I don't know what to expect. As I said, I haven't memorized all the stats in the world because they exist only in Matt's personal notes. Another thing I really like about it is combat in that game is lethal. Like, it's actually reflected on how medieval combat would be. I remember watching in high school for the first time. Here's a jump back to that show, that British show Connections from 1978.
That show is wonderful.
Love that
I
show.
Love it.
Love that show.
Burke was two saying, or three seasons.
Here exactly is what happens when you hit a side of beef with a broadsword, with a regular longsword, two chops. He cut the thing basically in half. And in this game, Fantasia is the name of the game from New Dimension, it's a normal character can take one, maybe two meaty hits, and he's dead. So combat is this hectic, crazy, fast-paced, holy shit, we're all going to die, I just swore sort of affair. And I really like that.
The swearing or dying?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. I mean, in Dan's homebrew, Skies of Glass, combat's kind of similar. It's something that when you're playing a game like that, you go in and you think, I don't want to get into this combat.
To explain this a little bit for Matt's benefit, it's a post-apocalyptic game, and I am with gunfire and modern weapons, I guess kind of what your friend is like with medieval weapons. And so getting shot is getting shot. Getting shot is not
a 1D8. Game of tag.
Yeah, it's not 1D8 hit points. It's a sucking chest wound. It's a hemorrhage. It's a shattered hip.
It's not Gears of War. Somebody touch me and I'll be okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Other games. I love a lot of old school games. My favorite RPG of all time is the ElfQuest RPG that Chaosium put out. Oh. I don't know. There was something about that I just really dug.
I didn't know they made an RPG.
No, they did. That is way back. Well, yeah,
I've got this old, battered, taped up cover copy version of it with the map missing because I found it used. Just a great system. And of course, I was huge into ElfQuest at the time and still am.
I might have to dig that up. Dawn, my wife, Dawn. That is like her favorite American comic book ever is ElfQuest.
Yeah, I do remember that RPG. In fact, I remember there's a store, or used to be a store here. Unfortunately, the owner died of cancer, but it was a place called The Hobby Shop. Yeah. And I remember seeing copies of it at The Hobby Shop back when we first got into gaming in the very late 80s, very early 90s. So yeah, it goes back quite a ways, but I do recall that game.
The James Bond 007 RPG by Avalon Hill.
See, I have to ask what your opinions on BattleTech are.
I've only played BattleTech once. I've read the material. I actually read more RPGs than I play because I like the source material, frankly. I like the ideas behind them. BattleTech, I never really got in a way. It's just like, I understand you're riding around in giant metal robots, shooting missiles at each other and hitting each other with hatchets, and that's cool. But I was never big into the miniatures, so I kind of gave that a pass.
There was a lot of BattleTech in order to really get what at least I came to love about the universe. You have to go beyond the box set game to some of the novels and additional source books, because it has a very, very rich setting, wonderful characters, has a great tone to it. I mean, the sense of sort of a future Middle Ages, but that's something that, yeah, absolutely, it does not come across in the box set.
There's a certain layer of impenetrableness about BattleTech.
Well, in BattleTech, though, it came from that older era of games. And I think personally, this is starting to slowly come around and cycle back when the games were more complicated, a little more impenetrable, as opposed to today, where the popular thing right now is the quick play rules and you're in.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that is slowly shifting back the other direction. I think within a couple of years, well, several years, you will see these thicker, crunchier systems make a comeback. I could be dead wrong.
Well, for me, it's all about percentages.
48%.
I don't care how crunchy the rule system is. I want there to be a larger percentage of story and story elements in a single role-playing game book than there is combat. I mean, I honestly believe that it is 10% story, 90% combat in most modern rule books. And I do see a trend. The only reason I like the quick play stuff, besides the fact that I really hate combat and dice rolling and all that kind of crap, but the reason I really like it is because the quick play rules are shorter and they're fitting in more story. There's more artwork, there's more story, there's more characters, there's more all that sort of stuff.
Well, or if nothing else, they at least say so absolutely little that the implied setting, it's like a Hitchcock thing. They say so little, your mind fills in the blanks.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you told us what kind of specific games you like. What kind of gameplay do you like? What are you into? Are you into the hack and slash dungeon crawl? Are you into the high art LARPing in the woods and go camping for 3 weeks all in character, or somewhere in between?
Haven't done that. I do like a mixed balance of story and combat. Like, I like combat when I like why we're fighting. Mm-hmm. In a way, you know, random encounters, those are okay. It's much more interesting to me when a character has something personally involved in the combat, aside from just, oh, I don't want to die and whatnot, which is, you know, it comes down to how much do I enjoy the character, because I don't play as often, really. I DM more. Mm-hmm. I'd say the one I like to play, I like to have the option to solve problems outside of combat.
That actually answers the next question I was going to ask, was this: do you prefer to play or DM?
I prefer to DM.
Could have told you that just from looking at the movies.
He's a writer director. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah.
I had a feeling.
Yeah, come on. He's a writer director who reads more role playing games than he ever gets to play, probably because his group won't let him run them. So.
Yeah, they make me play by the rules.
All right. So, two quick questions here before we wrap this up. Number one is, where can people follow you right now? Go ahead and give your web address, and we will also link this in the show notes.
Certainly. You can follow us at deadgentleman.com. We have a number of short videos and updates going on there. Most recently, we have an interview with the most famous, groundbreaking fantasy novelist ever, R.L. McSterlingthong. He's phenomenal.
I saw that banner ad on your website. I'm like, who the hell is this?
And just to be clear to anyone that's not...
I'll tell you who he is. He is fantasy.
He is.
And just to be clear to anyone that's not checking this show notes, that's Dead Gentlemen, not Dead Gentleman. That's with an E-N, not A-N. And my second question is, what do you guys have coming up? What is it you're working on right now that you can tell us about?
Well, most immediately, we have a couple of web series that we're starting. I mentioned my partner, Ben Dobbins. He and I and a third party, Kat Ogden, are starting up a new company very closely allied with Dead Gentlemen called Zombie Orpheus Entertainment. We have two projects in the pipeline. The second one, which is one that we're looking to be filming in September, is called Strowlers and is essentially 100 years after steampunk in an alternate history North America. It's less comedy and more serious, and it's going to be a lot of fun. That website is up now, strowlers.com, S-T-R-O-W-L-E-R-S. Might be pronounced strollers. It's an old word, you know. I don't know.
Once again,
anyone who uses it in conversation.
And once again, I will link this in the show notes. So if you're in your car, don't try to write this in the dust on the dashboard.
And I'll have to go look at that because I can't visualize that right now.
Post cyber or post steampunk?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like steampunk happened in, you know, in the 19th century, and we're 100 years past that.
We don't need steam anymore.
That's one of the main issues in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is a fantasy comedy web series that I wrote and am directing in March called Journey Quest that we are shooting very soon here. In fact, I'm running around in the throes of pre-production trying to make sure we have everything set. And that is going to be a lot of fun. Said it's a fantasy comedy. It's the same type of humor as Gamers, but it's taking the game out of it. It is actually set in a fantasy world itself. It's your basic adventuring party, completely dysfunctional, botching a very important quest that they're going on that basically triggers the opening events of a massive cataclysm that's going to wreak havoc upon them. And many of the people who were involved in Darkness Rising are there as well. I think it's the funniest thing we've ever done, and it's going to be awesome. The first episode should be up in July.
And just for the sake of asking, is there any chance of a Gamers 3?
Yes, there is. I actually have written the one complete screenplay that we optioned to Epic Level Entertainment, which is our partner production company that helped us with Darkness Rising. It's called The Gamers Pwned and is set in an MMO. And, you know, we're looking to, it was shopping that around to find, because that's one that we have Epic Level doing, because the budget on that would be in the low mills and is beyond anything we could do at the Gentleman. However, there's also talk of, and I've got outlines for doing a sequel to Darkness Rising that would either go into trading card games or be another D&D RPG-based game, but that takes place at a convention like Gen Con.
What important concept for your next movie? Have someone listening to a podcast.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to chat with us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been great.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I am a self-admitted fan of your movie. Like I said, it's amazing for me that I can sit down in a gaming movie with my wife, who has only played games at a con, and she can enjoy it and understand it. That's a major accomplishment in my eyes.
So thank you again for joining us, and thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you all next week.
See ya.
Later.
Bye-bye.
This interview has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com.